Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hang on. What are you doing? Look, this place is filthy. I did everything. I set up everything, cameras, lights, paid for everything. And you just waltz in here 5 minutes late.
So,
put your headphones on.
I think your girlfriend didn't clean the house.
Hannah, you are obviously have an issue with my girlfriend.
No, not at all. It's just the house. Yes,
at all.
So dirty.
It's not dirty. No, it's not. No, it's not dirty. Sorry, Ross. Ross, we should give you an introduction. Comedian from Cork. Radio personality, TV star, writer, everything. Sorry, Jack. I'm cleaning as I'm introducing. Yeah. It's a new fucking... I'm so annoyed by his success. TV star, fucking...
I'm not.
He wrote a book.
Yes. Yeah, go on, let's go.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to And That's Why We're Not Together, starring David McSavage, Hannah Andrews, and TV star, author, loads of other things, Ross Brown!
What were you saying, Hannah, about Ross's book?
I just saw that he wrote a book, and the plot is really intriguing.
Oh, what book is this?
Oh, it was more than one book.
Oh, they're shit. I wrote books back. I wrote two books and they were fucking awful.
Both of them? But I read the plot, it was that the guy comes back to Ireland. He's a New Yorker coming back, inherits a bookshop and find out mystery behind the whole thing.
Yeah.
Can you turn off my headphones? Sorry, Ross. My sons are really annoying me. Okay, a little bit. That's a bit too much.
Well, just saying, who doesn't annoy you?
Yeah, can you turn it down a little bit, Jack?
Point one
turn
person who doesn't annoy you.
Turn it down a little
Let
bit.
Let me guess. Is that your girlfriend?
Oh, Christ. Can you turn it down a little bit? Yeah. You don't know which is which, do you? Yeah. He's switching, fiddling.
Is it good now?
Honest to God. Is it good now? I mean, this generation are fucking useless.
Flakes.
They're flakes.
Am I the same generation?
No, you're
consider me as them.
Can you turn it up a bit, Jack? Sorry, Jack. You don't know which is which, do you? No. No, Jack, that's too high.
He's on TikTok now.
But okay, so can you just cut to where Jack is doing now? Jack doesn't fucking know
which button
corresponds to our headphones. Yeah. And we've been here for 1 year.
A year.
A year we've been doing this.
You change it up all the time.
And now he's putting echo. Why are you putting fucking echo, Jack?
I know.
Ah, Jack.
I do know what I'm doing. Do it.
Jack. Jack.
He's improvising.
Daniel, are we switching? I mean, Jack.
I think it's good to improvise. Whenever I'm asked to do a job, I always say yes.
Okay.
And doesn't matter if I know it or not, because there's always a fraction of time you can Google it up or find out.
You know, can I just tell you, right, there's some tribes in certain parts of the world that have not been contacted, Jack. And do you know how they live? Hunter-gatherers. And they have skills.
I wish I was there right now.
I'll pay for the ticket, you cheeky little pup.
Please do.
You little scot!
So I don't have to pretend to...
But David, that's actually... You don't know your son. This is Jack's ultimate dream, to live by the lake in a hut and hunt and fish and kill the bears.
Well, he's going to live in a van down by the river if he doesn't sort his stuff out.
Don't visit me, please. I'll be happier in the van down by the river. I'll be turning on the wrong cookers and I'll be like, no one's criticizing me for this.
Yeah, dribbling on yourself.
Yeah, and I'll be happy. I'll be content.
No one can see it. You know, you can do all those dirty things.
I don't think he's looking around to find something else. He's like,
no, I'm just, because I do every, like, how have I set this up? I shouldn't be too critical. Okay, sorry, Hannah, you were asking Ross about his...
Yeah, no, I was thinking that the plot of the book seemed... I've never read the book, so I can't say. But the plot was interesting.
The plot was
premise,
good. Yeah.
Premise, it's interesting. It's good.
Premise was good, but I used that as like... That was my first kind of going, I wonder, can I write, you know, a book? And then I accidentally self-published it. I should have actually just banked it, because the stuff I've written since then, I'm proud of. But I've never published.
Sorry, can I just... Sorry, Ross. Ross's mic doesn't sound right.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Yeah.
Is that microphone there working? No, that one. Yeah, that's on.
Maybe.
Oh, yeah, no, wait a second. How come that's on, Jack? Wait.
That one is not...
Hannah.
Yeah, your mic's not on, I don't think.
So Ross's fucking mic is not on.
Yeah, well, you put the fucking microphone there.
Okay.
You know, you say you're setting this whole thing up like brilliantly, and you're the one who put the fucking microphone.
No. Don't. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Boom.
See, he's accustomed to all the radio equipment. He's been doing. How long have you been doing radio?
Go on.
4 years.
Oh, now I can hear myself. I should have fucking copped that. I'm on the radio. Yeah, much better. So it wasn't the knob twisting was the problem.
Okay, guys. Can we, you know, you waltzed in here, you, Jack, and Daniel, 5 minutes late. Can you at least come in here about 15 minutes so we can sort the fucking sound out?
Usually, it's the guests are never on time, so there's...
It's my fault. It's my fault, guys.
No, I'll tell you what happened. I was ready to go. Hannah was late. And I get all the flack for it, you know?
Yeah,
I'm like David's punching bag.
So
it's
go on,
right.
How
I do my job
Jack,
well.
I love you, and I want you to be in a safe space where I can punch you.
Yeah, no, it's
but
fine.
But it's with my loving embrace.
Yeah, but, you know, it's fine, because your punches, they don't really feel like anything, you know?
Shots fired.
Hannah, can you, honestly, would you get that fucking water bottle out of my life?
No, fuck I need
me.
It, I need
fuck
it.
Fuck me, this fucking thing. Jesus.
And that's
Christ.
Why they're not together.
Every time I look down, there's a fucking landmine in the shape of a fucking water bottle, and it's always in the fucking up my ass.
Do you know that you have to drink
what?
1.5 liter water a day, at least?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, do you? You have to.
Well, you should.
Why do you, when you start talking about nutritional things, do you like suddenly look like you're a living god? Did you know that you da-da-da-da have to drink a litre of fucking water?
A litre and a half.
I'm so angry, Ross. I'm so sorry you have to see this.
It's
this show's been brought to you by Lucozade. Okay.
Actually, one of our comments said that David's much calmer when he's not drinking Lucozade. So
okay.
I think this is it's a good...
I love the deflection. I love the multiple rounds of deflection. It's like, no, it's Hannah's fault. No, it's the Lucozade. No, it's the water bottle. No, it's... I was too early.
Hey, Ross, how come, what was the motivation to write these books, crazy man?
Writing scripts all along, that was kind of me going, okay, I'd like to write a comedy series, I'd like to write a movie. And then they just felt so regimented that I was like, you know, the scripts have a very tight format that there's no kind of room for flowery language. There's no room for kind of self-indulgence. So I just went, fuck it, I'll just start writing something. And then as I did, story revealed itself and I went, okay, I really like this. So those first two books, I think I just kind of went, oh, this is great, I can do this. And now looking back in retrospect, I'm like, they were shit.
But the stuff that I'd written then subsequently, two other books, those ones I'm kind of going, okay, I'm proud of them. So I'm kind of like hedging my time going, I would like to get them in front of the right people because I think they are genuinely good books.
And did you study or did you do some kind of course or degree? You just jumped right into it?
Yeah.
But did just you not do research?
No, I did research on the topics that I was writing on. But
research in terms of structure, of architecture, literary architectural references. Like that's the thing I was name dropping earlier on because Martin McDonagh. Go on. Jesus, Jack.
I mean, well, you get back in my good books and then maybe I'll do your sound effects.
Is he smoking? Is he?
No, we shouldn't
mention.
We shouldn't
try to undermine our own sons, for Christ's sake.
Wait, I'm not undermining Jack.
Okay, I'm going to cut that out, Jack.
don't cut out anything. I don't care. What are you doing?
I care.
You know, you're just trying to build character in Jack, so he's like resilient. Because he's going to be knocked down.
Anyway, look, so I know this guy, Martin McDonagh, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know him and he's kind of affable and goofy and silly and fun. But there's this other section of his brain that he's able to write these stories that have this kind of, for use of a better word, structure. And they have they follow that kind of three-act carry-on. Yeah. And they have all these sort of literary references,
mm-hmm.
You know, that make people who are literary kind of go...
I see what you did there.
You know, well, film The Three Banshees of Inisherin, Three Banshees Beside a Billboard, having a fucking smoke with the Lieutenant of Inishman, well, Three Banshees of Inisherin. And so your man Colin Farrell, or Brendan Gleeson wanted to break it off with Colin Farrell. Mm. And then over on the island, you know, Ireland was separating from the UK and there was that kind of dichotomy. Or
Duality.
Mm.
Thematic duality.
There's levels of understanding. For a simple person like me, I might just see it as it is.
Yes.
But you probably see
layers. I think as well, like, even if we're like, if we're doing stand up or, you know, if you're writing something or you're presenting something, if it's something on TV or something on stage, people are digesting it on different levels. You'll have people that are going, oh, I see what Dave did there. That's very clever. You'll have other people going, he made funny sounds and he moved. Mm. They're all getting their own thing out of it. So it's kind of like, you know, they'll get what they want to get out of it, and that's up to them digesting it.
I wonder the people who go, he made funny sounds and he moved, are they more likely to buy tickets?
Yes.
Yeah. So let's make that.
Because the ones that got it are like, I'll stay at home and read a book and spend no money. Yeah.
So, well, that's pretty, you know, people think about writing a book. Well, to me, the classic definition of an Irish writer is somebody who believes they have a great work of literature inside them, but never publish it because that belief sustains them until they die.
That's one of my fears is to
have it
and never, like, it was sitting in a drawer on a laptop for the last 7 years.
Yeah, but you've broken the mold, Ross, is what I'm saying. But maybe from those experiences, you had to go through that to get to.
Oh, I had to put out something shit so that I could then go, okay, well, that's not good enough. Now I know what is better. So it's kind of like, but I did it
But it takes balls to put it out there. Yeah. Was there a moment when you put it out? Like, was there one moment where you think, who's that cat?
It's a cat.
You have a cat, remember?
Do you want to let her fucking in there?
No, it's okay.
Okay, just let her meow. Was there a moment, like, or was it just... Like, when did you realize, okay, this isn't up to, this isn't match fit, this isn't good enough for what I...
When I started writing better. So when I'd probably got halfway to three quarters of the way through Diary of a Vagrant, which is the one I haven't actually shown to anyone, that's when I went, what the fuck is this stuff that I was putting out there?
Diarrhea of a Vagrant sounds interesting. It's kind of a... it's like down and out. It reminds me of that thing. What was your man?
It's a homeless guy in San Francisco.
Okay.
And he thinks he's lost his mind, but he thinks he's physically lost it. So he's looking for it. And he can only speak 16 words. He can write everything, but can only speak 16 words. And he's obviously got trauma and PTSD and all these things. He doesn't know what it is. And he bumps into this woman. He sees this woman that he becomes obsessed with, or another homeless woman. And it's basically about him trying to ingratiate himself to her. And then through trying to kind of like win her over and woo her, ends up kind of fixing and kind of unraveling some of the things that he can't remember.
Oh, that sounds really, there you go. That's exactly what I was talking about. That structure and then all the references to what's happening today and social and political comments about like the homelessness in, is San Francisco or is it California where people can pitch up outside people's houses and they're not being moved along.
Yeah, it's Skid Row, they're just leaving them to it. It's a very strange situation.
Yeah. They're not, it was like that in New York in the late 70s and 80s. And they just had homeless people, well, very mentally ill people just wandering around and addiction and so on.
Yeah.
And then I think Giuliani came in, or Dinkins, and sort of, I don't know where he put those people or where they went.
Yeah, to be honest with you, they probably just pushed them out further and further from New York because they were trying to like gentrify it, you know?
Right.
With the Diary of a Vagrant as well, he's totally isolated because he can't speak. So everything that he thinks, everything that he wants to communicate, he writes down. So it's on empty cigarette cartons, it's on slips of paper. So he's just got these little concertos of little slips of paper. So the whole thing is written, it's been sequentially ordered, but it's all these random thoughts and musings, and the story is made up of all that. So it's all from his perspective. He hallucinates. Sometimes you don't know if something is a hallucination or not. So it kind of blurs that line then between what's really happening to him or is he having a moment or an episode as well, you know? So
whatever you do, don't get fucking Donald Gleason to play it.
I mean, you'd be perfect
for it.
We'd save on costume.
No. You son of a bitch. I am going for the posh vagrant look.
That would cost a lot of money. So the most expensive vagrant look possible.
Yeah, bougie homeless.
Yeah, what do you think of like the kind of male tights with shorts on top of it?
I only saw that when we got back from the shop and I was like, we were in the shop like that, were we? No, to be fair, I look like something out of the fucking Muppets. I do like the shoes as well.
Yeah, the slippers, they're hybrid.
I think only you, a homeless person, or Kanye West could pull that off, I think.
Kanye West, leave Kanye West alone, will you, for Christ's sake?
We all love Kanye West.
Is that how low you think of yourself, that when I compare you to Kanye West, you say
Jack,
he's
having a go at me now because he wouldn't turn, he couldn't figure out which button.
David, I'm not on your
it's
side.
Like having a little chimpanzee
I'm
over
not
there
on your
and
side,
it's like
David.
Which button is it? And then after a trial and error, like an hour later, he figures it out.
At least he does.
Well, you know, remember all the time you dropped me on my head? You know,
oh,
it's
Jesus
not my
Christ.
Fault.
Here we go.
Can you let that...
I can't hear the...
Like, you got to take a little bit of responsibility.
There it is.
She's just there, but I don't think she wants
okay,
to come
well,
in
just
she's
okay,
afraid.
Okay, good. Just leave it. Don't close the door so she can push it open. I'm so sorry, ladies and gentlemen.
Ross, I have a question. So what gave you the inspiration for the vagrant?
I like the idea of somebody being stuck inside their own head. And it's like everything that you say has already gone through a filter because you're putting it out there and you know you're going to be judged. So everything everyone says is kind of like has already gone through that kind of conscious filter. Whereas if he's just writing it down and he knows it's only for him, then it's complete pure thought. Then the shame is in there. What would you say? The honesty is there on the page.
It's
then.
A great way of examining, looking at the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
In this kind of really weird way, it kind of makes it's like it creates reality better than. It just makes us understand ourselves in a better way.
And also, if you're looking at a movie or something that's about a homeless person or any bit of art that's about a homeless person, a lot of it is done voyeuristically. Do you know? So it's done from our perspective, looking at, oh, the poor homeless man, he's down and out. Whereas if it's done from his perspective, looking up to the people that he thinks are fucking morons because they're running around from glass building to glass building and drinking their macchiatos. Mm. But then he's also looking down at other homeless people that he thinks he's better than. So you're seeing this.
Yeah.
I love that. The point, I just saw the lobster again. I hadn't seen it. Do you remember the lobster? Did you see the lobster?
No.
But, it's a bonkers premise, but it kind of shows, it's hard to explain, surreal stuff, can somehow hold a mirror to what we're like in a better way. It makes really good social commentary.
Yeah. That's why parody works so well as well, because right. if you're parodying something that's serious, you have to show it in a real, in a unrealistic and ridiculous light to show how ridiculous the actual right. thing is in its first place.
And you can kind of get away with dealing with hot button issues in calling it satire, parody, irony, or whatever.
Same as nursery, not nursery rhymes, but like you know, fairy tales. A lot of them dealt with those issues, but they you know, they packaged it up with like a big bad wolf or, you know, an evil witch or whatever. But a lot of those had social commentaries and lessons in them as well. So it's been done for fucking years.
But they seem to be, they seem nowadays to be cleansing them a bit and they're not as scary.
Yeah, they're diluting them a lot.
I thought, but I think kids
nobody
love
kills
it.
Anyone.
Yeah, yeah, right. Nobody eats anyone.
Legs. Nobody, you know.
Hansel and Gretel don't follow the breadcrumbs because they're like, are they gluten free? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I just wonder, you know, you writing from the homeless vagrant perspective, how do you do it? So have you ever had some sort of close experience to hallucination, seeing, you know, like it's a huge taking on to be honest, authentic, and did you talk to them?
I did. I sat with a couple of guys after doing gigs in Dublin. A couple of nights I went and sat with guys for the majority of the night and just sat and not asking them any questions, just literally just sitting with them and just being like, okay, this is what it's like. This is what the concrete feels when you're freezing cold. This is what it's, you know, this is what the wind chill is like sitting on O'Connell Bridge or whatever. But the majority of it really is just kind of going, how would I react in this situation? Mm. How would I react if I thought I was normal or I thought that I was the only sane one if I wasn't? So it's very much kind of, if you kind of boil it down to he's just a man, then you're not looking at it again from the outside looking in. Because the more I learned about his situation or whatever, I think it's better off to just kind of try and put yourself in and then look outwards. Because then you're going to go, well, this is honest for me because this is what I would think if I was in that situation, you know.
But my God, talk about, you know, so living rough. It's one thing living rough if you're in a forest, there's nobody around. Mm-hmm. There's no contrast between your situation and everyone else's.
Yeah.
But like being in the city and, you know, seeing everybody going into their homes and the warm glow of lights from houses. And people who are already vulnerable, I mean, talk about it, must really fuck with their heads, their self-esteem, their sense of self-worth.
That's why they're on drugs constantly.
Yeah. I mean, as well, I was in LA about 4 or 5 years ago, and even just on the way to the airport, you're pulling into the gas station, and coming out of the petrol station was like this massive mirrored Lamborghini pulling out, and right beside where it was pulling out, just waiting to indicate to turn, there was a woman lying on a piece of cardboard, probably 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, no shoes on, just like, and you're kind of going, the kind of, I suppose the wealth right next to the severe poverty, you're kind of going, this is fucking perverse, like, and you can't expect people with money to then be like, well, then we all just won't get our Lambos, do you know? But it's kind of like, you're kind of going, okay, this is, it's obviously systemic, do you know? But you're looking at it going like, you know, these two things do, coalesce at the same time, you know.
One time I was in, where was I, back in 1989 in New York, and I was commuting between Brooklyn and Staten Island, you know, and I was working in a construction site, fucking miserable, you know, geez, up at 6 a.m. and I was standing in some tube or underground station, and a woman, and you know, she just looked like she slept rough, and she just looked rough, and she was just standing there and she was looking at me. And you just hear this trickle, and she's just pissing, standing up, and while looking at me, and it was just so. I was only 21 at the time, but it was very frightening.
Yeah.
Just to see where, you know, how she'd got to this point where she's just standing in clothes that she doesn't wash.
I often
get just pisses it on herself.
I often get like this massive pang of anxiety. This is like a recurring thing that I have, and it's if I pass somebody homeless. This is before I ever wrote the book, right? It's probably why I was kind of drawn to it, is that I'd pass them and I'd go, how many wrong decisions am I away, or how many even bouts of misfortune am I away from possibly ending up with that? And it genuinely scares me that I kind of go like, if this went wrong, that went wrong, and that went wrong, then could I end up there? Like, you know?
But also, sorry, if that happened to me now, I'd say, can I assist you in any way? I'd get, so, you know what I mean? Like, I was a young kid and I was scared and I didn't know what the fuck. I'd never seen anything like that. Just to see somebody stand still and then you can hear the piss and you, oh, Jesus Christ. But anyway, now I'd handle it differently.
I find it interesting. I'm not having a go at you here, although you might think. But you know, you say you'd help the person, but like, would you actually help the person? Because that's another thing about homelessness, is it's such a frequent thing. But because there is a certain amount of choice involved when it comes to drugs, like most people have a view of homelessness as like, well, they don't really want help. And most people, you know, we all do. We all walk
by homelessness
every day.
I know what you mean, Jack. But I think in that situation where this woman is in such abject, dire situation. I'd like to think I'd offer, or I don't know. You're right. What do you do? Do you contact?
Because I had a kind of experience recently where I was in town and I was going for the bus, and this woman comes up to me and she's obviously on a lot of drugs and whatever, but she's going up to me. She's like, "Oh, my leg, and she's giving out about her leg. She's saying, "I think it's broken," and she's walking on it. So obviously it's not broken, but I don't know. So she's like, "Can you help me across the street?" So I'm helping her across the street, and you know, I see my bus coming and it's gone, and I'm thinking, all right, well, whatever. So I help her across the street, and then she's like saying, "Can you walk me down to the like wherever the center is, the homeless
and she's here today."
Focus Ireland Center. Yeah, she scrubs up well, eh? It was only a hairline fracture, but so I go, and then we're walking across, I'm asking how far is it. She's like, "It's only down the road." And then she's like, "Ah," she's like screaming in pain. I'm thinking, what the hell's going on? So I'm like, "Oh, are you okay?" She's like, "Call me an ambulance." So I'm like thinking, Jesus. So I call the ambulance, and I'm telling them the situation. They're asking me a lot of questions, and I'm also kind of saying I'm not gonna be charged for this.
Charged,
because I don't know, because I know if you call an ambulance, if you take it, it's like 500 quid.
When was this, by the way?
This is like a few weeks ago.
Jesus Christ.
And
why didn't you tell me about this, she's
sitting on the wall, and then her friend comes up, right? And I'm like, I call the ambulance, and I tell them, and the ambulance is like, "Listen, we don't know how long it's going to take, might be like an hour, 2 hours." And it's like, well, she's gonna, you know. So I'm just saying, I don't know if I can wait an hour or two. Her friend comes up and he's like, "Oh, what's wrong with her?" And I'm like, "You stay here now. I've got to go. That's your friend." And he's like, "Oh, no, I can't stay here. Yeah. And then it's like, in that situation, I don't know, I got the bus eventually. Like, I'm not going to lie and say I waited with her for an hour or two. I said, "Listen, the ambulance are going to come. You got to wait here." The ambulance calls me up an hour and a half later, and they're like, "Yeah, she should be there." And they're like, "She's not there." Well, you know, what can you do?
Because, you know, I think that, obviously, it's nice that you help her, but the help centers that should be somewhere in the city where they come in and getting better, and because it takes time. But there was apparently there was this project in the States that they gave women, it was for women, I think it was actually specifically for Black women who are quite poor, and they living from you know, month to month, and they're getting paid. So they gave them just extra money. So it turned out that giving the extra money propelled or made some of the women, and quite a bigger percentage, to better their lives. So get a better place, or come from homelessness, move into the place. So I think it's good that we're helping, but like, it has to be organized.
Yeah, it's coming from the, like, a lot of it is coming from the bottom up rather than the top down.
Yeah.
So you're kind of going to systemically broken, you know, it's the you know, the support systems aren't going to be funded properly, aren't coming trickling down to the people properly. Mental health is massively a problem with, like, I'd say 80 to 90% of people that find themselves homeless. There's obviously trauma and stuff there that those people aren't able to deal with. So then they're going to fall into those cyclical things of drug abuse and alcoholism, and obviously trying to numb the situation that they're in. And then from that not being able to be rectified, then you've people like, you know, volunteer groups. Like, there's a group that go around in Cork, and they literally just set up stalls every single night of the week, and they literally just feed people on the street.
Yeah.
You know, and you're kind of going, they're doing it out of their own time, funding their own money, cooking their own food, but they're not getting government. So it's not coming down, it's only going up. And you're kind of going, that isn't going
to
sustain.
And like, that feed, you know, it has to be more systemic. It should be help, you know, try, give them a safe
place.
Well,
yeah, what you want is to sort of light a fire inside the people.
But how do you do it?
Well, actually, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, the best country for that sort of stuff is Denmark, I guess. You know, they just, like, if you judge a country by how they look after people who are vulnerable and in need, like, Denmark is one of the best countries. But I'm thinking, like you're saying, you know, you pour money. Well, what does that mean? It just money. But where does it go? Who does it go to? Who's it? And I think it's almost like for people who are homeless or who have been homeless for a long time, or I don't know what their situation or what their mental state is, but it's almost like, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you want to, you know, get away from alcohol and start living a meaningful existence. You get a sponsor. So it's almost like a homeless person should get a sponsor or sort of some sort of life coach that, like, almost like stabilizers on a bike, just day to day to day. But I mean, it's hugely, I don't think people are willing to make that kind of investment,
no.
You know, so I think it, people just kind of send money to these agencies. I don't know. I don't think most people, I don't really know what the agencies, what services they provide to homeless people.
And I think what they're doing is they're just trying to tread water and keep the fire at bay. They're not kind of going, there's not enough to go, okay, this is going to fix the problem, or at least make headway so that the next generation or those people's kids or, you know, someone who's in their late teens, early 20s isn't going to end up in that situation. They're just going, let's find a bed for this guy tonight.
So it's containment, really, rather than getting in and...
There's no
dirty
hope.
With
it's hope, the- like it's hopelessness, I think, is a massive thing, because there's people that are working in this country that are, you know, they've got a mortgage and they've got kids, and on the surface they've got all the things that everybody should aspire to attain. They've got their two cars. Those people have no, like, there's a lot of people that are feeling hopeless in that situation, again treading water. So if they're hopeless, then how the fuck is somebody who's living on the street supposed to have any hope? And if you've no hope, then that's the fastest way to give up, which is to go, I'm stuck where I am, like, do you know?
Yeah, a lot of people are stuck in this situation.
I just looked up Finland and Japan handle homelessness the best, apparently. And the main thing for them seems to be, you know, in Finland, at least 25% of housing in a city must be affordable social housing.
Yes.
So it just makes...
Well, that's another thing, actually.
Yeah, but then those cunts in fucking government are going to be like, we're not going to give out 25% of social housing.
It's not cunts in government. It's cunts in...
Developers.
It's cunts all around. Everyone has an extra house.
But
Hannah, I'm saying, look at in this house, in this street, in this street. I've started, so I didn't talk when you talked.
Okay. I just want to have a drink, so I don't want to look aside, but I...
Hannah, what I'm saying is, in every street, there's abandoned houses, or there's a house standing with nobody in it, because some fucking family are
waiting for the housing price to go up,
right? And all that crap. Well, that's Irish entrepreneurship, you know, that's as far as it reaches with a lot of people. They just hang on to a house and hope it goes up, and then rent it out and divide it into six fucking spaces and rent it out to Ukrainians or whatever the fuck it is. And it's pathetic. There should be affordable housing, is all I'm trying to say.
But that's the government.
And I mean,
it should be
government mandated.
Government policies who are just supporting people. You know,
you think the government have their hand in it as well? So it's detrimental.
So
and also they won't get re-elected.
Yeah, and they're developers, and they're probably you know everyone's fucking buttering each other's
bread.
They're
enabling vulture funds to buy in front of normal people. They're giving them green light. You know, I'm not that knowledgeable, but I know that the policies are completely wrong.
Even if you're looking at landlords that are renting out places and they're renting out houses for exorbitant rent, you're going, there should be something in there that says that if you have a house that is valued at 300,000, you can only rent it, and it's capped at this much. And if your house is worth 500,000, yes, you can rent it out for more. But you have someone that's got a fucking bed sit, and they're going, "Oh, it's fucking 1,200 a month for one bed next to a fucking sink."
Yeah, you shouldn't be making it. Shouldn't be a fucking business opportunity when students, and we've said this before, students, for Christ's sake, desperate for a place because they're going to, and they're the future, and you're sort of cashing in or taking advantage of that desperation for a place to live. Yeah, it's so right. Like, why? But are they, I don't know who would be against that kind of policy. I mean,
someone that doesn't have skin in the game. Do you know? Someone that doesn't have skin in the game, which again lends itself against the normal kind of party politics system, because everyone's kind of going, you have to play the game, you have to grease the wheels, and you have to make sure that you're in with these people in order to get favourable fucking positions and stuff. So I think it's just non-conducive to progress.
But I think most people would be for that. Exactly. I like that idea of, like, if a house is worth that amount, you can't charge X amount.
Yeah.
Above what the market value of your house is.
So the politician would say, oh, this is stop the free market, you know?
Yeah. Because, I was talking to a mate, another comedian, and he's living in this house, and it's like, what is he playing? $2,000 or something. And it's a tiny little place.
No, it's insane. It's insane. You open. You remember when we, me and Daniel, were looking at apartments to rent? You know,
yes.
It's a bedsit. So it's a kitchen and a couch. You open the couch and his feet are actually in the oven because it's so small.
No, Hannah, feet are in the kitchen, yeah.
In the oven, they're just like, you should open the oven and put your feet in there and warm it up. And it's just like,
no, but
a new
but that's
invention.
Right. Because I was with Daniel when we were looking at different places. And it's literally like imposing depression on people.
Yeah.
These really little, shitty, little boxy rooms in these big, giant houses. And they're divided up into
shared bathrooms.
It's such an old racket. Mm. But then again, you know. I don't know. Is it a racket? If you had a big house, would you? I don't. Listen, can I just say, I don't think I would do that. If I had a big house like that, I wouldn't look at it as a money-making opportunity to try and, you know, scrabble. And like, I'd make it in a place that I'd be proud of, and that I'd want the people to enjoy living there.
Yeah,
I'd be embarrassed.
Definitely.
If it wasn't like that,
you want to make money, but you don't want to.
No, I don't
want to.
I just the money is the fucking value of the fucking house. But there's these little cunty little guys.
I think there are a lot of Vulture fans that are even worse.
I can't stand it.
You know?
Anyone that's making money, I think, if desperation is their fucking product,
yeah,
that they're making money.
Desperation is their product, yeah.
Fucking hell. Do you know? You make it on your level, or you aspire to make it above you and take some, you know, pull some down to you or whoever. But if you're taking it from...
I'm just trying to think, as you're saying that, I'm just trying to think, are we making money by selling tickets? Are people desperate?
No, we're just giving them the opportunity for joy.
Yeah, yeah. we first met in, I think it was City Limits.
Properly in City Limits. Yeah. We've obviously, like, we know, we were on the stairs of the International, and gigs like that and stuff. But I think the first time we ever properly, you know, chatted and stuff and got to know each other was probably City Limits. Yeah,
the International Bar, people don't know. I mean, it was started by Kevin Gildee, Barry Murphy and Ardal O'Hanlon.
Mr. Trellis.
I think it was started back in the early 80s.
86, 88, I think.
Yeah, and they called it The Cellar. Mm. I think it ran one night a week. And then I think, well, at some point Des took it over and then Aidan took it over.
Yeah.
And now... Simon O'Keefe is running it and he sometimes gives me gigs. No, it was funny. Apparently, who was telling me? What's his name?
Martin
Angola was saying I was bitching about Simon not giving me gigs on the last one laughing, which is this global TV show. And I'm
seen it. I watched it all.
Huh?
I watched it all.
Well, me and Hannah watched it and she said, I'm embarrassed for you.
I fucking loved it.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
I watched the Canadian one, which was fantastic. You got like Tom Green was on there and Colin Mochrie and some greats on there.
Yeah.
I watched the Australian one. I wasn't mad on that. And then obviously I watched the Irish one because I knew, you know, a good few people on it.
Mm.
And I thought you did great. I thought you did great with the you eating cereal out of your pocket just fucking...
Yeah, but I mean...
And I was putting myself in there going, dude, I think you'd... I was like, you'd got me. Tony Cantwell would have got me.
Yeah.
Jason would have got me like 100%. Deirdre would have got me as well. But I don't know what it is about Deirdre, even on a one-to-one level, that I'm kind of like, she's the type of person that would just look in your eyes and you go, oh,
yeah,
fuck.
Yeah, no, Deirdre has that look. She presents herself as if she's quite normal, but she's not normal.
There's
at all.
Divilment.
She's mental.
Yeah.
And she's quite dirty as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so we met. That's a pity because that club, City Limits, I used to like playing in that club, but I fell out with. I don't know. Is it cool to talk about that?
No, do you really want to?
No. Do I not?
There's another place you fell out with.
Yeah, yeah. It's just a long. It's just
people love hearing it.
Do they?
Sorry, I'm just going through the list.
The list. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, you know, this carry on and you know, you get it a lot. Now, I don't want you to get into trouble, but, you know, organizers and bookers, oh, you can't play there if you're playing my club. Would you fuck off? Yeah. Like, who are you? Who are you like that you think you have the power to control this? And, you know, I think people, it corrupts them, you know.
I think the power is back in the I think the power is in the comedian hands more so than ever. Like we were talking earlier about social media and stuff, and that there are less and less gatekeepers now.
Yeah.
And as well, because a lot of comedians are running the clubs now, or people that are very closely connected to the actual doing of comedy, rather than somebody who's like a businessman who just happens to go, oh, there's a gap in the market, I'll set up a club here. So I think now the lines between the gatekeeper or the person who's behind the desk and the comedians is a lot more blurred. So I think now the comedians kind of have more choice than they used to have. Whereas back in the day, it was like, please, sir, can I have a gig? I promise that, you know.
Oh, you mean the because we don't need to go through the well-worn path.
Yeah, we've autonomy now.
Creating, getting an audience for ourselves.
I think I went my own path a little bit to my detriment, to be honest with you. Like, I do feel slightly kind of...
Didn't you do that tour or something? Yeah,
so I went like, I feel like I'm slightly comedy scene adjacent. And like, I would kind of have issues as well, kind of like, even being around groups of comedians at festivals or, you know, things like that, I'd feel slightly withdrawn because I'm like, no one likes me. Or, you know, everyone's just like, fucking Johnny fucking Lately. They're just pops up for a gig every once in a while. Like, obviously, I emceed in City Limits for 10 years. So that was a very much a comfort thing for me because I was like, I have two gigs a week in this place, 10 minutes down the road. And then I kind of built, you know, an audience in Cork. Like, I play at the Opera House every year. That's 1,000-seater. So I have Cork, a good, strong audience in Cork. But then if I go to Galway, if I go to Dublin, I feel that I just wasn't present enough in the scene all along, that I was kind of, and I was booking my own tours in small little villages around Ireland before anyone else was kind of doing that thing. And I had my own little circuit that I carved out myself. I think that was, to be honest, a bit to my detriment.
That's right. I remember you telling me, how many places did you play?
The first year, so I was working with my dad. He was a contract cleaner. So you might have seen the cleaning of the desk. It's quite good. He was a contract cleaner. So I was working with him at the time. I was working another job at night, kind of doing security in a kind of entertainment centre. And then I was gigging as well. And I was doing The Fear on RT at the same time.
Oh, that's right, The Fear.
But I'd lost the job with my dad because one of his main contracts flooded, massive flooding. So he lost a giant contract for like a year and a half, 2 years. So I went into work one morning and he went, Ross, there's no more, you can't work anymore. And I can't even pay you this week because it was like disaster, half of Cork flooded. And I had to go home and be like, all right, there's no more money. So I was like, right, I have to do something. I either have to go like get a job in a factory, which is what I always tried to get out of when I was doing it, or I have to go and find my own work on, you know, so I had to carve out my own little circuit. So I think I literally started zooming in on Google Maps to find a little grey spot.
Yeah.
And I went, that's a village. And then I'd go over to Facebook or Google and type in pubs and clubs in this place.
Yeah, I remember you telling me about this. That's right.
And then I'd literally cold call them and be like, look, I'm on The Fear. I'm on this new show on RT.
What year was The Fear?
2015, 16 and 17,
oh,
I think.
Oh, really? I thought it was... Yeah. Anyway, okay. Yeah.
Maybe it was 14, 15, 16.
Okay. It was 2012, actually.
Fuck! Well, it was, sure. Well, you know, 2024. Yeah, 12 years ago. Yeah, my daughter would have been 4 at the time. Yeah, 3 turning 4. But like...
Anyway, so
I did 60 gigs. I did 60 to 70 gigs on my first tour. And it was booking places blind and just showing up and saying it's a guaranteed fee. If you think you can
sell
the
tickets.
What do
you mean it's a guaranteed fee?
So I just said like it's a flat fee. I started at 300 because I was like.
Oh, you pay that?
No, I just say like ye pay me, ye take all the door.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, then it went, obviously then as I book more places, it was like, okay, I'll try 500 or 600 or whatever it was. And I just built up all these gigs and just literally rock up and just.
I remember
some of them were
talking,
terrible, some of them were great.
Yeah, well, no, I just want to talk a bit more about that because there was. And, you know, touch wood, I hope I continue to be able to make a living and create a little bit of wealth.
A little bit of wealth. Sorry.
A little bit of wealth for myself, sir. But what I'm saying is, there was a very dry financial patch for me. Mm-hmm. And you were telling me how you were doing it. And that, to me, it was kind of like comedic gold prospecting. I was going out into them hills and, you know, cold calling. Panning for gigs, ringing them up. And, and you went there and you went there and you went there and you worked your bollocks off.
And a lot of those places I still play, like Mike the Pies in Listowel, which is, I think they've won like the Hot Press Music Venue of the year like 10 years in a row now. Yeah. But that was the first one I ever did. Yeah. And I rocked up and I opened the door and I had a baby blue suit jacket with pinstripes on, and the whole place just turned around with big turnip heads and were like, and I went, oh, this isn't going to work. I went straight out to the car, sat there and went, what the fuck am I doing? Mm. And then Aidan knocked on my car window and he was like, oh, Ross, come on into the back there. And then he started telling me about, oh, the crowd are great crack and they're lovely here. And he was telling me the history of how his grandfather owned the pub and everything. And it ended up being the best gig. Mm. Like, it is my favourite venue in the country. Mm. Even over the Opera House or the Everyman or theatres and whatever. Mike the Pies is like, every year I'll start my tour, my first date is always Mike the Pies. And it is the fucking absolute wildest but best crowds you'll ever see. It's fucking, it's magic. Like
In Listowel. Yeah, the worst gig I've ever done is in Listowel, but that was during the literary festival. And you know, the Kerry Head's just like, don't be thinking you can come down here and connect with us on any level, you Dublin Jackie fucking cunt. Go ahead, let's see what you've got.
See, all the sound people are the pies.
What?
But you know, like, Ross's accent is not.
Oh, that's
familiar.
Right. Well, actually, somebody's
no.
So it's so true. It's true-ish. But it's there's definitely any popularity that you or likability that you have is reduced by about 50% with this accent.
Easy. Yeah.
No, but listen, it's currency. It's instantly you warm up to you.
It's currency, because I think people in Dublin go, and again, it's that kind of like who's digesting what on what level, and they hear me go, "How's it going?" And they're like, "Oh, here's this tip from the country." Yeah, yeah. And then you've got that little bit of grace time to kind of win them over. So,
but I think you have to acknowledge. I realize definitely if you're going into a highly sensitive, vulnerable area like Kerry, you can't be going in with this accent. You have to kind of say, "I know." And acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And then fair enough. Well, at least he knows he's a cunt. We can listen to him now, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I did a gig actually. In the INEC. The
club one.
Yeah, the club one. Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did great. So, you know, but I did acknowledge, I did open up with apologizing for the D4 accent. So that's good. Yeah. So you did all those clubs. Whereas other people are sitting on their fucking hands going, I can't get gigs. You just went out there and did gigs. It's almost like a similar...
Those people ended up getting all the... Like I was there like every year. I look and I kind of go like, I'm not doing that festival. I'm not doing that festival. I'm not doing that festival. I'm not doing this thing. I'm not doing, you know, and I do feel like I'm slightly... And it's part of my own doing, but it was at that time it was out of desperation and necessity. Yeah. But at the same time, I'm kind of going, I'd love to be more... So I've actively this year and last year kind of went, I need to just... Even if it's not financially viable to drive up somewhere to do, I just need to inject myself back into the scene more because
I know what you mean.
I love the scene. I love being around comedians. I love doing gigs. So I'm kind of going like, I need to just be less insular and just kind of inject myself back into it a bit more. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know those comedy festivals. You know, there are certain people who are in, and there's a you know, I think they also have representation from certain.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're not in with those people.
Huh? No, I just remember some comedian said recently that he less and less likes to hang around after the gig. He just said he coming in, does the job, and get out. Who was that? It wasn't
Martin Angola.
No, it was Irish Australian. What was his name?
Jim Owen.
Jim Owen. He said he used to hang around. He used to talk. Like now, he just goes in and out.
But I know what you mean, because you've ploughed your own brow, so that you don't have the credibility within you know, this is why you're not maybe getting booked.
I'm seeing,
you don't
I'm
have
as,
the representation.
Oh, that's you're, Ross. He does loads of other things. He does the radio. That's his main thing. Yeah. He writes for TV. Yeah. That's his main thing. He just does a gig whenever he wants a bit of extra cash. I think that might be kind of like, you know, oh yeah, Ross as well. It's kind of like, you know, because I'm not, I suppose it's because I'm just not like in front of people as much as I, you know, would like to have been, you know. So
do you see yourself primarily as a comedian, or does that not really matter for you what you are primarily?
Like, I don't even say I'm a radio presenter. I say I'm a comedian on the radio.
Okay, right.
You know? Oh, and let's talk about your radio show, the 96?
Yeah.
Six?
Yeah.
96 FM.
Yeah.
We're here, the morning show with Ross.
That's cool.
And
clip that.
The morning, Ross and
Lorraine. Yeah, Lorraine and Ross in the morning.
And how long have you been doing that?
So I was doing a radio show. I was doing the same slot, but for about 6 years. And then last July, we started the new show then. Mm. So my old co-presenter left, and then Lorraine was doing the evening show. So then she came to the mornings, and then another guy who was doing a nighttime show wanted to produce our show, and he's kind of like a third person. So similar to the lads, he's producing the show, but he's also on mic and on camera all the time. He's a full, like, he's an outstanding radio presenter in his own right. So the three of us are just like, he's almost like the fourth Beatle. Do you know what I mean? He's always he's always in.
It's
on
good
everything.
Comparing yourself to the Beatles, Ross.
Yeah. Shout out Buckley.
Is it true about radio in Ireland that it's more watched than television?
Listen.
Watch.
Listen. More listened to than television.
For fuck's sake.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Do you to be licking the radio more than the telly? It is. And it's kind of, I thought, like, people, you always hear kind of like, you know, you hear people on American podcasts, and you hear people, Australia and Ireland are the two most, I think, like, nothing has dropped off radio-wise. England's still quite big as well. America, radio's just dead. Like, it's gone. You know what I mean? It's still around, but, like, it's not what it used to be. But Australia, like, your Kyle and Jackie O's, and your Jason PJ's, who are doing a Capital, I think. And then you've got, you know, Irish radio and English radio. They're probably huge. I think Irish people, they want that voice in the kitchen, voice in the car.
Yes,
that kind of thing,
you know? I find it, I do like to have something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Buzzing in the background. Yeah.
Is that because we're not comfortable in our own thoughts?
100%. I think it is. I think genuinely, if you're left silent, you're then going, how many bad decisions till I'm home?
No, like,
so you need someone just going, what's your favourite type of sauce? Ketchup or brown sauce?
I know, but I can't. Now, that's the one thing. I don't, that does my head in slightly. I look, you know, so we're talking about the people's favourite colour, a couple of back, you know, people's favourite.
Dude,
you know,
it
so,
kills
hey,
me.
And, what? Yeah. My favorite color is brown.
Yeah,
because it's like your surname.
we had a rule when we first started this new breakfast show. We were saying, the day that we say, do you keep red sauce in the fridge or the cupboard, or if you say, do you like pineapple on pizza, we're fucking done. So, like, we don't we try to keep everything as authentic as we can. Obviously, they're more kind of like radio, like they're absolute pros of what they do. My job is to derail the show, and their job is to keep it on the tracks. And that's where the kind of the crack and the banter and the, you know, having a laugh comes from. But we're very honest. We, like, if we think a song is shit in the radio, we'll say, I'll go like, what are we playing? And that's completely against
but
what
we
should be
even
doing.
Even you just saying that, right? And especially with Cork people, because people fucking love honesty, and it does have. It's almost like hearing a song being sung in tune. It just puts you, at ease, you know.
But also,
and even if you disagree with the person, but he's been fucking honest.
Yeah.
But that sort of, you know, but it's still around. It's still a lot around. And you think, has radio not fucking evolved?
Yeah.
It's
and then there's the other type of people that are the people that don't have either. I don't know what it is. Maybe they feel constricted by, like, the type of show that they're doing, or they don't feel like they can take the risks, or maybe they're doing it on their own. So they are, like, a lot of the old school jocks would have talked on their own. So it's basically like they're talking to you at home. So they're like, you know, what's everyone doing for the weekend? Let me know, blah, blah. Whereas we have the three of us to just be like, I'm going fucking bowling. And, you know, Lorraine's going, I'm going for a run at the weekend. And Bucks is going, I'm going to Dublin with the missus. So we have that. We don't have to put something out to the listener what's your favourite type of sauce?
Well,
we can just have an argument. Like, we're having a chat here. And then they feel like they're actually sitting at a table next to us in a pub overhearing. And that's what I think works, is when people go, I feel like I'm eavesdropping on three friends rather than having some fella going, hey guys, you know, what are you up to for the weekend? Send me in your plans, 083-396, you know?
Hey, we should do that. Can't we do that? Do live Insta, and we could do a video call with some fucker who's, hey, what are you doing for the weekends? And they just call up, you're a cunt. You know what I mean? Fuck you and your weekend plans, you piece of shit, you collapsed bastard. Would you fuck off and run into a wall with your mouth?
Rude.
No, I know, but I mean, I wouldn't say that.
So yeah, I think that's I think I'm in a very fortunate position that I'm almost like the antithesis to what you should be for radio. And I think that's what a lot of comedians on the radio should be, is like that little kind of agent of chaos that should be there. But I think, you know, it depends on who's, what support you have in the station as well. Like, we've got a program director called Brendan, and he just lets us, like, he's like, he gives us guidance and he gives us, you know, advice and stuff like that. But he'll pull us in, and, you know, if even if something wasn't to his taste, he's like, ah, but it was fairly funny. Or it might not be the typical radio thing to do, but he'll still give us the room to go, you're doing your show. I'm giving you enough room to kind of like, you know, fall on your sword if it doesn't work. But if it does work, you're off to the races. Whereas he's not micromanaging everything we do. Like,
it's fairly cutthroat, though, isn't it, radio?
Yeah, commercial radio is very cutthroat.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, they don't let you, they just, like, from one day to the next, you're off the air kind of thing.
There's people that do their show. I've heard, like, stories of people that do their show, and they literally walk out to the corridor, and the guy's waiting in the corridor and says, can you just come in a second? And he's like, you're done and you're not on tomorrow, because they're afraid in case the guy will go on the next day and be like, fucking Jerry's a cunt, Mary in accounts, and like they go rogue.
Oh, I see. Is that where that comes from?
Yeah.
So when you're out, you're out.
A lot of, no, some places will,
they'll
will
give you a few weeks.
Some places might say, look, you can work out to the end or whatever. But a lot of places, particularly if someone's moving from one station to the other, they don't want them to be like, hey guys, this is my last show. You can catch me on QL3P2 from tomorrow from 9 o'clock.
Oh, I see.
You know,
yeah,
so everyone's very, you know, it is, it's very competitive.
But and also, so you have a book, like you were talking about, this book. What is this? The statistics of listeners?
Oh, yeah. What the fuck? I'm the worst person to ask, because I'm not a radio.
But anyway, a statistics in terms of listenership comes out every 3 months.
JNLR, that's what's
called. JNLR. Yeah. And so, but who looks at, like, I suppose radios, oh, of course, advertisers and all that kind of thing.
That's why it's important. That's their tool. Like, I'm always like, I don't really care whether it's up or down. Plus, it's done by a survey. So like, one person who surveyed counts as 1,000 people.
Yeah.
So you're going, if you ask that house or that house, you're going to get two different answers. So it's where the surveyors decide to go or happen to rock. So it's not accurate. It's not like they can go, we know how many radios are turned on and what's listening to what. It's not like the Nielsen ratings in America. You know?
And can people communicate to, how do people send messages to the show? Do you get, I'd say.
It's all WhatsApp.
Is it? Oh, right.
We've a text thing. I don't even open the SMS thing, because no one, it's all WhatsApps, and it's all voice notes as well, which is good, because you're actually getting a sound of the people that are listening.
Do you like our setup here, Ross?
I nerded out when I came in. I was like,
do you like what microphone? I like, this is the Shure.
That's Shure, yeah.
That's a Dyne.
Sure. No, that's Shure as well.
No, it's a Dyne. Anyway, Ray Darcy, when I was on the last one laughing, he recommended this type of microphone.
Okay.
Anyway, I just thought these are
our headphones as well, the DT770s.
Yeah, DT770s.
Yeah.
DT770s.
Sounds really good.
DT770s.
But listen, I just wonder, is your radio
Pro
really commercial, or is it connected with national,
like, state broadcaster kind of thing? No, it's commercial and it's regional as well, which means that we're in Cork, and, like, you know, maybe you might pick us up slightly outside.
Because then there's a lot of commercials cutting your show, is it?
Well, I mean, they're selling advertising. That is the business, you know, model as such, is that they're kind of going, if the show is popular and they get loads of listeners, then we can sell ads and, you know, promos and competitions and stuff like that. But
sometimes it's really annoying, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's too much.
Hannah works in RTE. Hannah works as a makeup artist.
Do you put the gold on the hands for the handshakes?
Very good. Yeah, do you, Hannah?
Yeah.
A lot of controversy recently, big exit payouts for, what was her name?
Breda O'Keefe,
who's a chief financial officer who got paid €450,000. But it was very bad, because that job was continuing. Somebody was going to take over. So you can't get that amount of money. You shouldn't have. She shouldn't have been allowed.
I was surprised that DG, he really defended her so much. Did you hear? And I was. That was.
Do you know that would have paid us for a season of The Savage Eye? 450
easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. Easily.
You know.
Like sick, you know what I mean? So it is quite extraordinary that somebody...
Yeah, and the funny thing is, let's say I work on Fair City, so, and sometimes you work on, they call it EFB, so outside, so there's a van when they, you know, editing everything and the director's supposed to look at the monitor. But, you know, they do savings. They just don't buy the proper monitors, they buy TV.
Okay.
So there's no proper lighting, the colors are not there, they can't, the cables don't fit. So, you know, so they expect people to work on equipment which is not suitable for that kind
paying,
of work.
That's because they're paying because fucking 50 producers for one show. The amount of producers in RTE is fucking ridiculous.
But you know what it is? It's like RTE, right? I was just watching Lord of the Fellowship of the Rings, and you know, what do they call Middle Earth? Hobbiton, where all the hobbits live?
The Shires.
And it's like RTE have built like this, like a skyscraper in the Shires. Mm. They have this total overblown sense of the size they should be. It's like, you know, what are you paying executives kind of UK level money? You're not that, we're not that big, mate.
Yeah, and also it's like,
and the
like
equipment, I mean, the equipment is just not up to scratch, the equipment. They expect people to work on secondhand sort of over the date equipment, you know?
Do you want to hear a story about what I heard about? Okay.
Yeah.
So I was at a RTE launch years ago. Okay. Mm-hmm. Can't remember who it was, but I overheard a conversation from somebody who was, I suppose, in charge of, like, you know, commissioning or whatever it was. I'm not sure, but it was one of the suits that was there. You know, it was the people that were kind of like, you know, there on RTE's behalf kind of thing. And I heard one of them saying, "I don't see comedy as I." He said, "I see comedy like the Angelus. It's a public service that we have to put on." He said, "But if it was up to me, I would have like just really cheap reality shows on with just people filming their own shit and just putting it up and sending it, you know, like kind of like fly on the wall, TV fucking three shite."
Is TV3 still around? No, it's Virgin Media.
Oh yeah, it used to be TV3. But he said, "I see it as a public service." So like, as in, I've no passion for putting on a good comedy. This was post Savage Eye. He was like, "I've no passion for putting on good comedy." He goes, I see it as the Angelus. I see it like the Angelus. It's like a thing that you just have to put on." Well, there's a fucking great...
You can see how they put on the comedic TV shows of that time were kind of like the Angelus, like the quality of them, you know what I mean? Like,
shoestring budget, just kind of get something out there so we can tick the box and go, well, we also do comedy, you know?
Oh, I see. That's the world. And sort of it's reflected in a lot of the output.
That person, I mean, again, we're talking 2012, 2013 when I was over here, and that person could be three people gone, like, you know?
Yeah.
So, but the
mentality is still the same.
Well, I think RTE,
the culture.
That person is still got, but that person was probably promoted because you fail upwards in RTE. But it's shocking.
Definitely got a golden handshake.
Yeah, it is shocking though. The it shouldn't be that they shouldn't be paid that amount of money. Even half is still quite a lot.
I'd see.
225,000. It should be paid like, I don't know, €20.
But then you're watching people that are, like we were talking again about social media and stuff, and you're talking about, you look at the people that are making the stuff that they want to make with zero to no budget, but their own ingenuity and their own kind of like, you know, kind of auteur sense to it.
Yes.
You're kind of going, those people have nobody to say, no, we don't like that. It's like, no, you want to put it out, your audience will find you. That's way more
so exciting.
Pure, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's such a revolution, and I'm so glad and I'm so thankful. Hallelujah. Yeah, it's a pity to hear about that kind of attitude because, look, I remember doing The Savage Eye and the people running the comedy department, but they had no framework of reference. They didn't know the history of televised comedy. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd mention a show and they'd have no idea what you're talking about. That's a really bad sign. Like, I want somebody running, you know, the light entertainment or whatever, who has passion, who has knowledge, who gives a shit, cares, who you know, I'm not saying like Armando Iannucci, but somebody who knows what is required to create a great script and the amount of work that goes into it. Because, I mean, that's the cheapest part of any production is the script, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
It's just time is what you're paying for, really. Yeah. And that's even if the person's getting paid to write it. If they're not, then they're just doing it on spec. But like, if you look at, same way we were talking about, you know, politics earlier on, going like, you know, okay, if you want someone who's a minister for education, you'd expect them to have had a job as a principal of a school or a teacher or something like that, not just some fucker who just worked his way up politically and then became, same way with like people that are in charge of developing comedy, commissioning comedy. You go, surely they should have either ran a production company or worked somewhere in the industry where they had feet on the ground and go, I know how this works and I know the problems and how can I help get, you know, new writers, new producers, new directors, new actors in, and then they can go, that'll just help me commission better comedy.
Yeah.
Like anyone I've interacted with in BBC, fuck me, do they know their stuff.
Yeah, great.
Holy shit, they're fucking unbelievable.
Yeah.
They're so smart. They're so supportive.
Yeah.
You get notes back from them and they're just like, this is fantastic. This is, you know, I like this. What about exploring going this way? And as a writer, then you're going, oh, I feel like they're on my side rather than I'm trying to hoodwink them.
Yeah, it's their area of expertise. Yeah. It's very refreshing. I just did this. You're writing for young offenders.
Yeah.
And how long have you been doing that?
I've been writing with Peter Foote for, 8 years, I'd say, on all of his projects, whether it's, you know, screenplays or TV shows, whatever. And then I've always been kind of like writing with Peter on everything he's done. So when he was writing Young Offenders, he might have turned around to me and said, hey, can you write some voiceover for Connor? Or, hey, can you finish this scene? Or, hey, let's write this episode together. And I'm over his shoulder and we're both kind of, you know, I'm putting in my input and stuff like that. But for the new series now that's coming up, Peter was like, here are your episodes. Go off and write these. And then obviously Peter comes in, you know, after I've written a draft, and then he'll kind of go like, I like this, and we start working on it together, and then he'll go, oh, I like this, but we'll take the end of it this direction or whatever. So, it's a co-writing, like this year it's a full co-writing credit where like I came up with the ideas for the episodes from scratch, which was fantastic for the ones that I'd written, you know.
And of course, the reason I ask you, because I did a little, could you call it cameo? No, I'm not.
That's when you do birthday requests now, isn't it?
No. Anyway, I did.
Hey, John, I hear you're 47.
You know, because of you and other people, I got a part in the Young Offenders. I think I was only on it for a day, but it was a very nice. It was a great, actually, lovely, lovely crew of people.
The crew is absolutely bang on.
Yeah, really.
And it's the same crew that's been there for the last 3 seasons. Yeah. So, like, everyone knows each other.
Yeah.
You know, there's a WhatsApp group that goes on throughout the year, so that when everyone's back, then it's like, it's not like they're kind of going like, oh, who are these? Now, obviously, there's always some new people and stuff, but it is that kind of that feeling of like, hey, everyone's back together for the crack, you know.
Good. Now, but it's about a year ago almost that it
was. It?
Geez, nearly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
I have no concept of time since COVID. Now
I'm like, I know what you mean. Yeah.
I'm like, hey, young. I'm like,
but I'm really looking forward to it. It was. Oh yes. Oh no. Okay. I won't
remember
say,
your NDA yeah, now. Yeah. Remember your NDA.
Yeah, no, but anyway. No, actually,
I'm doing the work for BBC, guys.
It was a very fucking good scene.
Oh,
and it was.
It kept well.
I don't know about me, but I'm just saying it captured. I can't say anything.
You can't say anything. Yeah,
But I thought it was great,
David.
No,
you are fantastic on screen.
Ross, no, darling, you darling are wonderful, darling.
You are fantastic at telling us how much water we should have a day. I have had no water yet. I'm fucked. I need to.
Me too.
How long have we been broadcasting, Jack and Daniel?
An hour and 4 minutes.
It feels longer. No, that's not. That's not even. Daniel, just quick. Daniel is tired of doing Nicolas Cage.
He's not.
Go on. Give us something about Nicolas Cage.
Wait.
B-C-D-E-F-G-S. Daniel is. Oh, look, Daniel's got his beard shaved.
Yeah, shaved.
Look at how young he looks.
Yes.
Ah, Jesus.
I feel like we've been just attacking Nicolas Cage.
Not attacking Nicolas Cage, just keeping up fandom.
Paying tribute.
I know, paying tribute, but I feel like maybe it's run its course.
You've heard it here first. Daniel is having an existential crisis about Nicolas Cage news. I like it because it's so minuscule. It's just concentrating on one actor, and in a way, he is it's the universal.
I know, but if I had a larger pool of things to...
Well, wait a second. to me, it sounds like you didn't even look into anything.
No, I did.
Okay, what did you do? What did you look into?
Well, he was...
What's the latest? Come on, it's interesting. I want to hear.
Have you ever seen when Nicolas Cage showed up on Terry Wogan?
Oh, that's the best.
Office when he did the front flip. Yeah.
When he did the what?
He rolls in. He's just like a cartwheel in there.
Like kung fu. Fucking.
Was he? Do you reckon?
He was office.
He was only 26, but the fella looked about 40. You know what I mean? He looks the exact same as he does now. Like he's proper. Like I don't know what the guy. But can I make a recommendation for Nicolas Cage? Nicolas Cage scene to watch on YouTube. It's from his movie Bad Lieutenant New Orleans, which is the most unhinged Nicolas Cage you'll ever see. And there's a part in the movie, so he's a detective. There's a murder that took place. Young boy witnessed it. His grandmother works as a carer. He goes in there to... So he's been looking after the kid. He left the kid in the hands of his prostitute girlfriend, played by Eva Mendes, by the way.
Who is it directed by?
It's directed by... don't know.
It was directed by the German guy...
Yeah, Herzer Wernock.
Oh. Werner Herzog. Now, and the reason we like Werner Herzog because he also narrated Grizzly Man. You know that fantastic documentary about Timothy Treadwell, who goes into the fucking where grizzly bears hung out.
And, he also
ate, I think, the sole of his shoe. Yeah.
Oh, Werner Herzog.
Yes.
Or Herzer von Werner. Okay, sorry, Jack.
I want to know about him eating the sole of his shoe. How is that possible?
No, there was a
great... Was it rubber or was it edible?
No, he said he'd eat his shoe of something.
Yeah. He it was just a... what do you call it?
A wager.
Yeah.
The Bad Lieutenant, fantastic film. And there was a great scene where Sonny Terry and Branny McGee's music was playing. They're the best harp blues players ever. Sorry.
But the scene I was talking about, so the kid's escaped. He can't find the kid and he's gone back to the care home. So the carer is there, the old lady, but she's looking after this woman with the tubes up her nose. And the door opens and you just see Nicolas Cage shaving, dry shaving with an electric shaver in the door. And he starts like, gets his gun out. He's like, where's the boy? Where's the boy? And he ends up taking her tubes out. And he's like, if you don't tell me, I'm not going to put it back in. I'm going to shoot you. And then the carer eventually goes, Mrs. Whatever took him to England to her family. And he's like, okay, sorry. So he puts the tubes back in. He's like, go on, breathe that good shit. And then he turns around and he's on like 4 days no sleep. And then he turns back around. He's like, you know what? I should kill you right now. Fucking sucking up your kid's inheritance up your breathing tube. And but it's just a maddest movie. Anyway, watch that scene.
He chews scenery.
What?
He chews scenery.
Yes, he does. Okay, well, so Daniel, Jack assisting his brother.
Yes. Well, I actually thought your book that you're writing, the Story of the Deviant,
Diary of a Vagrant.
Vagrant.
I like Story of a Deviant.
Yeah, Diary of a Deviant is good. DD.
Diary of a Vagrant. I thought it's similar, reminded me of The Fisher King. I don't know if you...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Robin Williams.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. Was Robin Williams that?
Yes.
Yeah, Robin
Williams. Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
Kind of... the premise, or well, not the premise, but the similar kind of
circumstances.
It kicks off the same situation kind of thing.
Do we have any conspiracy corner, Jack?
Well, I have one of my own conspiracies that's linked to what we were talking about today.
Go on.
Well, it's about homelessness. But I think, homelessness since like the 60s, 70s, 80s has risen incredibly in Ireland and all around the world. And like theft, all these kind of stuff. Like I've said it before, but my granny used to tell me that when she would go to work on Westmoreland Street, she'd leave her bike up against the wall or up against a lamppost unlocked for the weekend. She'd come back and it'd be there. Now, if you do that, you'd leave it 2 minutes, it's gone, right? And
a second,
yeah, literally. And what I think, I mean, whatever, it's a conspiracy. What I think, the government or whoever introduced drugs like heroin, opiates like these into society, because it would, push people down, make more social issues, so that people were distracted by stuff like homelessness and things like this. So that's my, what do you think on that?
Yeah, that's fact, everyone.
I think CIA
heard it here
was
first.
Working.
No, but what you think about that? That governments or whoever would introduce certain drugs into society as a means of control.
Well, I think it happened in US and then it trickles down to different countries.
It seems very, very, very dark arts. It's very dark.
But the CIA, they do dark arts.
Mm.
Well, you'll often see those things of conspiracies where they'll put agents, you know, these fucking, you know, for hire fucking merc agents or whatever, in plain clothes going to all these demonstrations and rallies and fucking, you know, dressing up like Antifa people and fucking smashing up the place, and people are going, they're standard issue boots that guy's wearing. You know, these people that are pointing out these things going, you know, you saw this guy had a Punisher fucking hat on or whatever, and they're going, that's whatever it is, fucking Monsanto and all this kind of shit, you know.
But, well, there is a, that did happen during the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
So,
agitators.
Yeah, agitators. Yeah. So,
It's funny, just the nature of, well, look, some of it is true, and it's really.
A lot of this is true.
By the way, I'm just saying this for an interest.
So are you saying that RT is trying to get everyone hooked on drugs in RT so that no one knows about the handshakes?
How else are you going to watch the
RT
fucking thing?
RT did amazing job to scare everyone and make them stay at home during, you know, pandemic. What was they doing? They were just, doing propaganda.
Wouldn't that be an amazing premise for a movie where that, like, a massive media mogul decides to, like, lock everyone away in their houses again so they all have to digest the media that they're creating?
Yeah. He came up with the whole thing.
Copyright that shit right now.
Ross, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
When are you? You're not on a tour soon or anything like that?
I'm going to be kicking off in September. I'm going to be doing the Cork Opera House in September. It's like half sold out now, which is going quite well. And then I'm going to be adding more dates as we go along. So, and
where can people follow that?
My Instagram at only Ross Brown, and then. I don't even know what my fucking handle is. See, this is how fucking bad I am at social media and fucking promoting myself, that I just go, you'll find me. It is called...
Not real.
I'm definitely not the real one. I'm a Ross Brown Official. I must have changed it at some stage.
Ross
Somebody did make up a fake page. Ross Brown Official or Ross Brown on whatever.
Thanks, Ross.
TikTok.
Was the only Ross Brown linked to the only...
OnlyFans.
Ah, for fuck's.
You can pay me monthly if you like.
Any premium naked content jokes for the people at home?
Thank you, Ross, and thank you for having me on the Young Offenders. That was great.
Not my choice.
Great experience. Not my choice.
Were you yourself, Ross, on Young Offenders?
I always pop up every now once in a while. So they'll basically, like, Peter will just go, "Do you want to do a day?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And so one year I'm a delivery driver. The next year I'm a fucking fella at a bus stop. The next year I'm standing in a queue for something. So I just walk on set for a day, do a few lines, and then fuck off again. So it's handy.
Thank you, Hannah. Annoying me a bit. And my two young princes, Jack and Daniel. Is that it? See you next week, folks.
I thought you have to say.
What do you want me to say? Oh, yeah. Like and subscribe. And, follow us on all our social media channels.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.